Hi there. Welcome to the latest episode of our Artemis Live podcast. We hope you're enjoying these recordings from conferences that we've held and our other thoughts on the insurance and securities industry. Remember, as ever, you can stay tuned at Artemis at www.artemis.bm. And please do rate our podcast in your favourite podcast app, be that Apple or wherever you like to listen to this, as it really helps us to pick up more listeners, and we appreciate that. So for this latest episode, we're bringing you what was the fourth session of Prospectus 2021, our annual reinsurance and ILS conference that looks ahead to the next year. This particular session was titled Terms and Conditions, the Need for Precision, and focused on T's and C's in insurance and reinsurance and ILS, looking at both the loosening that has happened during the soft market period, the decade or so running up to 2020, and the expectation of continued tightening as the market moves into 2021 and beyond. Terms and conditions are often overlooked dramatically when people think about risk-adjusted returns on reinsurance contracts and ILS, renegotiating terms, tightening up the terms, improving the terms, be that the coverage itself or terms around elements like release of collateral, can make a significant difference in terms of the potential for return from those contracts over the course of a year or more. Strengthening terms of insurance and reinsurance, both to improve the clarity of the coverage and the precision of the payouts when loss events occur, is seen as a key way to enhance the product for the customer and also the underwriting returns for the companies in the sector as well. During this panel, it was pointed out that in the ILS space, there's been a focus on quota share terms and there's been a toughening up on aggregates and a shift away from cascading coverages already. This was a trend towards market players looking to secure more favourable T's and C's. And this progress has clearly been beneficial to some, but is this enough or was there a lot more work to do at the renewals? The panel featured Heather Kitson of Convex Re, Michael Millette of Hudson Structured Capital Management and James Parker of Axis Re. And they discussed the continuing shift to ideas like named peril coverage, how certain areas of the market were already ahead on this, such as in the catastrophe bond sector. The discussion also covered the need for alignment between parties and how this can overcome terms confusion as well. In addition, cyber risks were raised as a topic where terms and conditions are vital, and also so-called intangible risks. These risks that are often under-measured, under-covered, less well understood as well. But there's work to be done on terms to contain these and other areas where difficult to predict losses may lie, the panelists discussed. So I hope you enjoy this session. Please do listen to it in its entirety. Towards the end of the session, it moves away from terms and conditions to a discussion on product design and how important that is up front to ensure that the terms are right and equitable for all sides. So it was a very interesting session, this one. So I hope you enjoy it. And do please stay tuned to Artemis at www.artemis.bm. And if you do enjoy this podcast, please give us a rating on your favourite podcast app or service. Thank you. Hi, everyone. Welcome to our first panel for Monday at the Prospectus 2021 conference. Thank you for those of you who have joined today to view this. We're delighted today to have with us some experts from the industry who are going to talk about the fact wordings, terms, and precision of coverage have really received some of the closest scrutiny in some years, and the renewals that in January seem set to see further tightening of terms and conditions as the industry tries to make its coverage more predictable and uncertain for itself. The pandemic certainly drove an element of risk aversion and also awareness through the industry, while also causing unexpected losses in some quarters. And the industry's become increasingly aware that rate is not all that matters at renewals, and that risk-adjusted gains can also be made through negotiation of more favorable terms. On top of all of this, there's an increasing discussion on the need
need for greater transparency of what is covered, as well as simplicity in making terms more readily understood for the protection buyer. So this panel is going to focus on what matters in constructing more robust portfolios of risk with respect to scrutiny of wordings, terms and conditions, and how that can deliver a greater level of certainty, predictability, and clearer coverage. So I'd like to introduce our panelists. We have Heather Kitson, Deputy CEO of Convex Re, based in Bermuda. We have Michael Millett, founder and managing partner of Hudson Structured Capital Management. Now, unfortunately, Michael's video isn't working, so we will be able to hear him, but unfortunately, you won't be treated to a video view as well. We also have James Parker, Chief Claims Officer for Axis Re, based in Zurich. So I'm delighted to have the three of them with us today, and we're going to go straight into the questions and get started. So before we dive into how the pandemic has changed industry motives, I'd like to step back a little and to sort of discuss some of the widening of terms we've seen through the last decade or so, alongside softening of reinsurance rates, terms and conditions such as areas like the hours clause, event-related wordings, and covered peril descriptions sort of stood significantly looser than perhaps back in 2010 at this point. And clearly this was partly in reaction to the softening as the capital base sort of ballooned, especially within the ILS market. But I'm also interested to know whether you feel that period created some issues or challenges. And perhaps we could turn that to Heather first.
Thanks, Steve, and good morning to everyone. Thanks for hosting this fantastic event, and it's a real treat to be able to speak to everyone today on what's something that is very close to my heart. To give you a little bit of further background on me, I started life as a dispute resolution lawyer in London back in 1999, focusing entirely on insurance and reinsurance before returning home to Bermuda in 2005 to work for one of the new startups here back then as general counsel. I've personally experienced a couple of market cycles over the last 20 years, and in my current role as Deputy CEO of Convex Re of Bermuda, I now not only look at things through a legal lens when it comes to contract wordings, but also a commercial one too. In a soft market environment when capacity is plentiful and outstrips demand, reinsurers' ability and indeed appetite to push back on loose wordings and broadening coverage is reduced, and this is particularly the case in a subscription market. Historically, there's been an overemphasis and reliance on computer models, which, as we know, are often inaccurate more times than they're accurate, and there's a focus on rate at renewal and amount of premium through the door. The rate may have stayed the same on paper, but there's not necessarily a full appreciation, certainly on a portfolio basis, as to how coverage in the contract wordings may have expanded and therefore reinsurers' exposure may have increased, for example, by the addition of words like direct or indirect losses or the broad creep of ex gratia settlement terms, which could lead to unexpected outcomes, both in terms of the type of loss and quantum. Pricing and gross written premium are just two factors in delivering improved returns for shareholders of reinsurance companies. And of course, the loss ratios are a key driver of profitability. Vague or ambiguous wordings are not good for anyone, let alone our clients. And it's very important for us as a market not to lose sight of the fact that a contract for reinsurance is a promise to pay. And that promise to pay is on the happening of certain fortuitous events. It might be a relief to some that I'm not going to go into great detail on reinsurance law, but the key is that promise to pay is enshrined in the contract wording. And insurance and reinsurance is built on a relationship of trust and doing what's right. We must always act in a straightforward and fair manner when it comes to our clients and contract interpretation. I haven't seen any major revolutionary changes in reinsurance wordings over the last 20 years in terms of operative clauses. But over time, these wordings have been put to test against a modern and changing risk landscape, whether it be terrorism, frequency, storm severity, wildfires, or now more recently, obviously, losses from the COVID-19 pandemic. The wordings have continued to evolve, but not necessarily keep up with the modern world. I've seen issues around event and causation language that can sometimes be conflated. often in the same sentence, and it can be a challenge to work out the interplay of the clause mechanics as a descriptor of the event or as a time limitation on losses. In terms of hours clauses, and in particular, the extension of time for certain perils, these need to be carefully considered as regards the ability to aggregate losses within a certain time period. Longer hours aren't necessarily better for clients who need a clear understanding of how losses can be aggregated and the application of reinstatements after an event. And Steve, I think finally, what I would say on this matter is that the broker and the underwriter are there to ensure that the client's needs are clearly articulated in the contract. And this hasn't always happened in a soft market. And there needs to be a continued common sense market discipline around the quality and clarity of our wordings.
Great. Thank you, Heather. So I'm now going to turn to Mike from Hudson Structured. Mike, I'm delighted to see you as well now. So thank you for resolving that video issue. So perhaps you could give me your view on sort of whether the softening resulted in a stretching of terms that was perhaps a step too far in some cases.
Well, I think that we had a few things go on. We had a softening in the market over a long, calm period. It brought capital in that urgently needed to be put to work. That caused terms to broaden out. It actually caused structures to develop in the market that really had been quite rare before. And there are reasons that they were rare, because they tended to be susceptible to misinterpretation. And we are seeing the market grinding back. It's very, very hard to reimpose terms and conditions discipline. And we're seeing that now. The market is slowly grinding back to terms and conditions that can actually be managed. In particular, in the cat market, we saw in the soft market, in the softening and then soft market that started when Hurricane Wilma left the Atlantic coast of Florida and ended when Harvey came into the Gulf Coast of Texas. You know, in that softening and then ultimately soft market, we saw, first of all, the development of more retro capacity, more and more aggregate retro capacity, and then finally a lowering of attachment points. At the same time, we saw events start to gain in frequency. We saw post-event inflation start to increase. We saw climate change influence the accumulation of events. And we saw unmodeled perils like fire and flood that formerly had been really much below the radar screen of the cat market lift up into the cat market. So those things have come together fairly catastrophically for the market over the past 4 years. The terms and conditions have placed, as well as attachment points, have placed the market right in the way of increasing event frequency. And we're going to have to pull back from that. And that, you know, we've seen some pullback, for example, on cascading. We're going to need to see pullbacks on things like co-participation.
Great. Thank you, Mike. That's a really good overview. James, as a claims professional, have you witnessed the effects of this term widening firsthand?
Yeah, and I'll happy to answer from a claims perspective, just to be clear. I'll answer it a little bit more, probably slanted towards the reinsurance perspective, just because that's where I sit now. But I'll try and bring in some insurance claims perspective too. But in answer to the question, I can think of probably quite a few examples. I'll give a couple of specific ones here, and then maybe a couple of other more generic examples that I can think of. Heather mentioned the hours clause earlier. I think what we've seen there has been an increase in general over this time period, certainly an average of the number of sort of hours allowed per hours clause. That probably culminated in what we saw in the Australian bushfires in late 2019, where probably most were already at 240 hours. And in some cases, we even saw 672 hours. And that's particularly relevant, I think, picking up on the point just now in relation to wildfires and the fact that they've gathered frequency and momentum in the last couple of years, because of course, by definition, they're more of a slow burner. And we've seen even this year, you can have wildfires ongoing weeks, months even. So I think in that context, that's been particularly significant just in terms of the increase of the number of hours themselves. The second example I'll probably give, again, linking to bushfires, but this time probably the relevance could be seen a bit more specifically in California, certainly in 2018, where we've seen over time more of a move towards so-called plot drops or radius clauses in treaties, which have had the effect way beyond probably just the hours clause, because they usually entitle a cedent to pick the spot where they drop the plot. And you get there within what is usually 250-mile and sometimes 150-mile radius, potential aggregation and collection of losses within that zone. That kind of will entitle you, or is certainly beneficial in more recent times when you see one or two or three slightly dispersed but very large wildfires, to merge the two in some cases to maximize a collection under one limit. More general sense, I think we've also seen kind of leaking into wordings, either notable by their absence sometimes or sometimes by their lack of specificity. Acceptance of maybe market norms. So I think where there's there's a tendency to accept certain named perils, for example, in a marketplace, so okay, well, this is a natural peril, that's a natural peril. There's been a tendency to sometimes hold off of really specifically listing all of those out. And that is something which I think, particularly now we've seen with coronavirus and COVID and so on, something that's going to be challenged. And probably finally, the phrasing that's come into some of those lists that we've seen, I think, a move away from exhaustive lists, and probably towards phrases that would list some and then have a phrase not limited to. And the minute we start bringing in vague wording like that, that's open to a lot of interpretation, that removes a lot of certainty and can certainly broaden coverage. So that's the final sort of piece, I think, that I would highlight over the last decade.
Sure, thank you, James. And obviously, that's something and securities markets
I want to jump on that,
sure.
Steve, because that James just gave us the sort of centerpiece of indiscipline. When you walk into the steel gateway of a soft market, above your head on that arch, it says including but not limited to, because that is where trouble starts. That's a lawyer full employment act, because that is exactly the basis for discussion that we're having around coronavirus, which clearly has nothing to do with what anyone ever contemplated to be a natural peril. But including but not limited to language is just the beginning of mischief. People need to be more disciplined than that, all of us.
Sure, yeah, no, I was going to say that's something that the ILS market's been very familiar with the addition of other perils as a category within catastrophe bonds. And part of this is obviously trying to match different types of coverage in the capital markets in some cases, but I think the 10 years or so of softening has driven the market to a point where it's now been trying to roll some of that back. And perhaps 2017 to 19, the frequency and major events all coming together in that period really began that process. Mike, do you think that was a turning point for the industry to try and get their portfolios back to a state of being more predictable, or is that now something that's going to be a challenging state to get to given climate?
Well, that is the challenge for the industry. I think that the extent to which the industry can sharpen terms and conditions will rely on the supply and demand of capital that we're seeing at this year end and over the next year, and also and that is something that I'm just a little bit concerned about. Regarding the supply of capital, I think that there's quite a lot being raised in the aftermath of coronavirus in the form of equity. Equity capital raises have a leveraged effect on capacity, and so we'll have to see how disciplined that capacity is deployed. And on the other side of the equation, we still have to see what kind of losses emerge from coronavirus. You know, originally, I think that we expected to see $15 billion of capital being raised against $80 billion of losses. Now it looks like we're seeing over $20 billion of capital being raised against over $20 billion of losses. We'll have to see how carefully people can restore terms and conditions in that environment.
Sure, very good point. Thank you. So James, maybe moving on to you, do you think 2017 to 19 has been sufficient of a scare to help the industry sharpen its pencils when it comes to T's and C's?
I think in terms of the 17-19 cats, it's certainly focused the minds, I think. And to your point earlier, it's focused them on the need to achieve much more balanced portfolios and thus stability and arguably predictability of outcome. If we just look at the major worldwide loss listing of some of the highlights from that period, I think it emphasizes exactly this point quite well. You look at 2017 in there, and it's obviously dominated by the major Atlantic hurricanes, Harvey, Irma, Maria, on the east coast, but also on the west coast. Coming back to fires, we had notable fires, Atlas, Tubbs, and so on. 2018-2019, the focus shifted a bit. We had the wildfires again, and we've spoken about their increase in frequency, but it also became Asia's turn, and we've seen typhoons Jebi, Faxai, Hagibis, really major inshore typhoons for the other side of the world this time. So I think what just that fairly condensed period of time is showing us is really the need to avoid these concentrations of exposure, particularly in time of sort of broadened risk, and to make sure you have balance in your portfolio. Avoid knee-jerk reactions. You don't want to go from one location to overexpose in another, because as that those examples just shown, the next year it could be that one. So I think the key to it here is focus on getting a balanced portfolio, and just avoid over-concentration in any one area.
Yeah, thank you, James. And I guess it's also interesting around aggregates as well when you look at years like this year too. Heather, any points you'd like to make on the sort of 2017 to 2019 period?
Yeah, I think a lot of good points have been made, and just to highlight, I think the fact that reinsurance contracts have also responded as intended. I think when we look back at claims paying history, and you know, I don't want this discussion to be that there are things that are necessarily fundamentally wrong. I mean, in my market, in the Bermuda insurance market, we've paid around $35 billion in catastrophe claims payments. And absolutely, James, recognizing the importance of creating balanced portfolios, managing your aggregates, but really it's on us as reinsurers to pay attention to the contract wordings, clauses like directly or indirectly, or what is or isn't incidental. You know, now is the time at renewal to have those conversations and make sure that we're clear on the exposure that we're taking on. And frankly, if we get an unintended outcome, you know, that's on us. If the contract wording is clear, then we need to make sure that we pay claims quickly. I think one of the things that perhaps hasn't been touched on, particularly when I was thinking about the California wildfires back in 2018, And James, I think you made some good points on the radii. I think there was a story about one client that drew the center of his radius in the middle of the ocean in order to sort of maximize the maximum recovery. And there was actually nothing in the contract to stop that. And I think we've seen, you know, some great improvements. But one of the things is looking at this language across primary, reinsurance, and retro. And if you take wildfire as an example, unlike excess of loss reinsurance, which is often event-based with no loss occurrence limitation in terms of hours and radii. And this works well for perhaps hurricanes and earthquakes on the retro side, as it would be unreasonable to expect the reinsurer to demonstrate all their involvements from a particular time or place. But with a wildfire loss, however, there's not necessarily the unity of cause, and you can be left with a scenario where you have an unintended mismatch in what was intended to be back-to-back coverage. So I think the point that I'm making is that we can't look at clauses or contracts or even portfolios in isolation. We really have to look at how we are defining these key perils, key events, and how the contracts fit together right from soup to nuts, from the primary to the retro side.
Great. Thank you, Heather. Mike.
I was saying, I just, you know, the image that I was trying to bring out before, what happened in the lead up to the 2017 to 20 period, and then what has happened in that period. In the lead up, attachment points came down and T&Cs broadened. So you went from, you know, the immediate post-Katrina environment was a named peril environment. It was actually, broadly speaking, a named peril per occurrence environment with broad co-participations. And so over the quiet period, we had attachments come down and we went to, you know, to including but not limited to perils with very little co-participation. And then what we had, let me give you the 2017 to 2020 environment in four words: frequency, 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 frequency. We have had this strange frequency apocalypse, and part of it is just frequency. You know, there are just periods of time in history where a lot of things happen, like 1995. You know, nothing happened from 1979 to 1985. Sometimes a lot of things happen, but there are two other forces under the radar screen, which are climate change and the litigious environment in the United States in claim settlement, that are just lifting up and lifting unmodeled perils, which is the fourth frequency. So we're in an environment now where we've had a bad patch of frequency. We've had more landfalling hurricanes in the US than any year we've recorded. In fact, the last year that was even close was 1916. But in addition to that, because of climate and because of post-event litigation, all sorts of other perils are lifting up into that environment of low attaching aggregates with very broad wording. And so those things have come together in a way that the industry is finding very hard to deal with. And I think some people just think, well, let's bang up the rates 20%, next year might be clear. And that may be true from an event perspective per se, but it's not going to be true from a climate perspective or post-event litigation perspective. So I think that we have to treat some of the forces that are driving industry losses as being more permanent. I'm sorry, Heather, go ahead.
No, I agree with you entirely in terms of frequency and severity and the sort of the new modern world, but setting that against the landscape of the contracts and the coverage which we are providing, you know, that's on us. That's on us as reinsurers to be better underwriters, to use the data and then to determine, you know, which our loss pick. It's not, you know, something, and then be very clear in the contract. It's not a problem within the contract terms and conditions themselves.
Yeah, I think that the number one, if I were to put my finger on one item in the whole morass, a move back to a named peril environment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a named peril environment is because so much of what's happened, you know, we used to think about cat risk as shake and wind. And we haven't had a lot of shake and wind over the past. I mean, we've had some wind, but that hasn't driven the losses outside of Maria in Puerto Rico. Like, we What we've had over the past 4 years is business interruption, water, and fire. You know, business interruption was Jebi and of course, Corona. Water, you know, Irma, Harvey, Florence, Sally, you know, were in many respects water events. And then, of course, California's been on fire more or less continuously since 2015. So, you know, every fall and early winter. So getting back to a named peril environment, I think, is really fundamental.
Thanks, Mike. Really interesting. And also actually a good point about the fact that the losses have actually come from different areas to where people were most familiar with. I guess convective storms is another area that's become one of the biggest drivers of industry losses year after year. And needs to be maybe treated slightly differently as a result. Heather, going to move on to talking about COVID-19 now. Obviously, a pandemic comes along and suddenly terms and wordings are dragged into an even greater focus in the industry. Could you speak a little bit about the industry-wide issues regarding contract certainty and clarity surrounding the pandemic coverage and also how perhaps you've begun to address some of these things?
No worries. I'm happy to and sort of make some broad observations. You know, unfortunately, I think coverage and contract interpretation issues are likely to be played out in the courts for several years to come across the direct reinsurance and retro wordings. I think, you know, for the reasons that we've touched upon in terms of these were unintended coverages, they were unmodeled, unexpected, potential outcomes, which have, you know, been incredibly significant. And I think whilst it's tempting to think that there'd be a silver bullet court decision. And I think, it is today that the FCA test case appeal is being heard in the Supreme Court in England. But I'm afraid to say there's likely going to be some more legal action in the future, and each case is going to turn on the specific wordings of the policies in question. And with no offence to my legal colleagues, when you have to call in the lawyers to work out what you meant in the policy, I think something's gone wrong already. And it's up to us as a responsible market to fix this for our clients and also to manage the risk of our portfolios as a whole. And I agree with Mike's comments in terms of really focusing in on named perils, and frankly, less is more. And we want our contracts to do what they say on the tin. It's up to us as a market and for everybody in the value chain to fix some of these uncertainties. But how do we do that? You know, what is or isn't business interruption? And we fix that by language, and language is by its very nature up to interpretation. When I was a trainee solicitor in London, the start of any coverage opinion was running off to the library to open up the Webster's Dictionary to work out the natural and ordinary meaning of any word. And then you open up the dictionary, and then you get another word with another natural or ordinary meaning, and so on and so forth. And I think that, frankly, less words are better and not necessarily more. It's quite easy to describe an earthquake by a measurement of the shaking of the ground and the radius, or describing a windstorm. But it's really challenging to actually find the words to define the pandemic or communicable diseases by way of efficient exclusions. And certainly we at Convex have seen that brokers have been on the front foot this renewal season in terms of sending across draft exclusions for communicable diseases, and these have been absolute. But these will take some further refinement and crafting, but we are starting to see some convergence on some LMA wordings, which means that we don't have to reinvent the wheel each discussion. I think if deals are done and the wordings of these exclusions are a conditioned precedent to conclusion of the contract, we are in danger of getting into the murky waters of contract certainty back in the old days, where contracts were concluded without key terms being decided upon. And I think, you know, we really need to ensure that we maintain market discipline And finally, I read in the news yesterday that some primary insurers in the US have sought regulatory approval for communicable disease exclusions to hopefully eliminate some of this uncertainty in terms of going to and eliminate the need to go to court on the primary side. So, you know, in summary, we've started to see, you know, the market has suffered losses, which were unanticipated. And going forwards into the renewal year, you would look, you know, whether it be, frankly, with wildfires or whether it be with losses arising out of the pandemic, which were, you know, unintended. We're looking to, you know, either exclude or make very clear, you know, what coverage is available. And, you know, I think we'll probably see the evolution of some product innovation, you know, not only in the traditional reinsurance market, but the ILS market too.
Great. Thank you, Heather. So I'm going to move on to Mike now for your view from the ILS market. Obviously, the exposure to pandemic risk was a surprise in some quarters for some investors in the space. What was the reaction at your firm, and how did you deal with that uncertainty and communicate it to people? And I guess also, what are you doing going forwards for the renewals regarding pandemic exclusions?
Let me talk about a couple of things, because I want to react to something Heather said with a whole different way of thinking about this. But how did we communicate? You know, of course, investors understand that aggregates picked up other perils, and they correctly anticipated that this would be a question, perhaps one that resolved itself without loss, but a question around coronavirus. We started to have calls with LPs, so we organized on calls with limited partners starting in March. And I think it was probably around the beginning of May or in late April, we actually brought together a panel of three different lawyers, two from New York, one from London, with one of our advisors, Liz Mitchell, who's the former CEO of Platinum Re in the US. And they talked about these contract issues, what they were seeing in the courts, for our LPs for about an hour, and you know, and had a detailed question and answer session. So LPs do want to, they think about these issues, they are actually pretty sophisticated about these issues, and we try to communicate as much information as we have. I said I wanted to take a different perspective. You know, Heather and James, part of the problem that we have is the fundamental jankiness of a lot of these contracts is that we are insuring an early 20th century, an early 21st century economy with an early 20th century insurance system. And what I mean by that is the premise of our insurance system starts with the notion that there are facilities that might be burned down, and that was expanded over time to other perils. And, you know, businesses need to defend themselves against physical destruction. And so then you get like business interruption, if but only if there is a physical loss, and alternative expenses. And actually, the whole insurance system is kind of upside down, because the world isn't so tangible anymore. You know, over 70% of assets in the S&P 500 are intangible assets. What businesses actually need, the starting point for business insurance is commercial multi-peril, at whose core is a physical damage policy. What businesses fundamentally need is a business process policy, which covers cyber, reputation, intellectual property theft, business continuity and interruption. And then, you know, the physical facilities need to be covered as well. But for most businesses, they're actually less important than the business process and intellectual assets.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mike. Heather or James, any comments on that?
I think Mike, I agree with you entirely as to the sort of archaic nature of insurance. Actually, I take it back even further in terms of marine insurance. A lot of our law in England certainly was about cargo losses and the sinking of ships. And actually, only recently, back in 2015, did we see any changes to the Marine Insurance Act, which was the incredibly archaic and trying to retrofit that law around modern events. I think that absolutely, our job is to meet our clients' needs. And I think clients need a broad range of solutions. I think I would pause slightly as to how we would model for all of that in sort of one package of risk. And I think it would be important. It's important to break it out. And I'd like to talk a little bit about cyber if we have time. But, you know, I absolutely agree with what Mike has said.
Yeah, and a short comment from my side. I would say two things. Firstly, I think I agree with what Mike said, but I would point out that there is, I think, still a place for the physical damage piece. There's a lot of insured risk out there, many of which are throwing up very large market losses because they are very big, very important physical structures, you know, refineries and the like. But that doesn't detract from the point that there is, there's a whole second piece to it, and I entirely agree with that. And there's an opportunity there, maybe especially now, to tailor products exactly like that, because what we've probably stuck with at the moment is seeing a lot of the elements, cyber and others, that are leaking into somehow or trying to be forced into these traditional coverages rather awkwardly. So maybe now is the time to look at extracting those and trying to make some better, clearer, standalone products for them that you can get a separate premium for.
Well, I mean, companies need them. Like, it's actually glorious to have companies needing a whole array of products that we only partly provide at this point.
Absolutely.
What a great thing to wake up in the morning and your business needs to actually grow. But growing them the way we are, which is, you know, we refer to goods on dry land as inland marine because the industry still has some coverages that are driven by 18th century imperatives. You know, that. Restructuring, you know, cyber is actually a reasonably well underwritten policy because it's generally done freestanding. And, you know, explicit cyber is generally done on a freestanding basis, and the TNCs are crafted very carefully and discreetly. And so the cyber industry has some substance. And then actually a bunch of other losses just bleed into commercial multi-peril or other physical coverages because of loose wording. So yeah, reversing it, so you actually really carefully word it. You thought about business processes and tried to carefully word and think about the things that endangered business process, like reputation, like cyber, like, you know, outage, you know, and just underwrote each of those, and then just carved out and made physical damage separate, discrete, like very tightly contained coverages. I think it's the fact that the industry bases its coverage model on sort of auras around physical facilities that causes us to get into trouble, because that's not actually what our customers need. Our customers need a lot of they do need the physical coverage, but they also need actual process insurance.
It sounds like there's a whole other panel session here about product development coming out of the focus on terms and conditions, really, which is really interesting. James, I was going to come to you about the pandemic and just ask you sort of at Axis, obviously you being in the head of the claims department there, you must have been among the first people to begin to get a real sort of sense of exposure to pandemic risk from COVID, where it came from. But was the internal response a complete review of terms and conditions and wordings at that point? Was that how you began to really assess the potential exposure?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, obviously there was straight away the recognition is this is definitely unparalleled kind of event and throwing us into a whole new arena of potential exposures, and that's very much the way we treated it and treated it very seriously. So it was very much a tiered approach. It sounds obvious and simple, but you know, I think it's very important to do the basics first. So it was literally drains up. We went through all lines of business trying to think, you know, as outside the box as you can or as untraditional as you can of where might something get claimed in any of these lines of business that we write. And we literally started that broad. Next tier down, you've identified a few lines of business sort of that are obviously more exposed, certainly upfront than others, first party lines typically. So we focused there, and then it was really dredging up all of the wordings, the terms and conditions in all first party lines first, and almost kind of literally bucketing a lot of those terms. As there's certain, at the end of the day, there's a relatively limited number of sort of clauses per section, if you like. And we were looking at some of the things we've already spoken about. We were looking at, is it cause, event, or catastrophe worded? We were looking at, is there, within named perils, is there a but not limited to, and so on and so forth. And then you start to build a picture, even just by going through these tick boxes of, okay, here we know we've got more exposure versus here, and you sort of literally then work your way down. But I think ultimately what's important to remember, so certainly in this context, is that in the end, it's very much every case on its own merits. That's going to be core to our approach. Now, within that sort of overarching umbrella, it becomes very much case by case. And I think it's important to remember that, because there's no one size fits all here. And what you sort of often see is that maybe one clause or a piece of a clause that you considered in isolation, in terms of is this strong, is this weak, the complexion of that can very much change with a certain treaty and a certain client when you put it in the context of the wording as a whole. Because sometimes it links to or is tailored to some clause that's much earlier or much later in the wording, and you have to read it also as a whole to interpret or get to the meaning of what it means for that particular client, because it's not necessarily always the same, even if that one clause might be the same as in another treaty. So you really do need to consider individually each case on its own merits in the end.
Sure. Thank you, James. I guess that also raises an interesting point around standardization as well, and how that can be cascaded through the industry going forwards to help help people have better certainty on terms. Heather, with the renewals obviously fast approaching this year and this focus on sort of terms and wordings and toughening them up, really in being sort of followed in many quarters in the marketplace, I guess, how do you think that's going to play out in renewal negotiations? Do you think, obviously, people are hoping terms will be more stringent, but are they going to get to the stage where the terms are accepted, I suppose, as well? And you perhaps hinted at this earlier.
I think we've covered quite a lot of this today. And James, I really liked your points on, you know, making sure that you look at the contract as a whole and you look at the contract mechanics. And there's a, you know, a rightful focus on the contract. What solution are we providing to our clients? And you also pick and choose your battles, you know, and those battles are around clear definition of perils and making sure the contract does what it says on the tin for the clients. I think it's important to get across that it's not tightening and tightening and tightening of reinsurance contract terms and conditions. Whilst it's important to be clear, it's also important to meet our clients' risk needs. So I think that there's going to be some really good conversations and some continued conversations this renewals about old contract wordings, which frankly have just been rolled forwards without due care and attention, not only to make sure that exposures are clear, but are we really meeting the needs of our clients, and are we looking at the landscape as of the contract as a whole to make sure it fits those needs? And I think, you know, it's not long ago that we were talking about the fears of disintermediation of brokers and whether we really need underwriters, and could this risk be simply commoditized? And I think actually, in my view, now more than ever, there's a real clear need for solutions and clearly articulated solutions for clients with complex risks. And both underwriters and brokers and risk managers have a real distinct role to play in this. So I'm seeing some really good and proper attention. But I feel that that attention will be focused on the operative clause going right to the root of the risk.
Thank you, Heather. Mike, from your side in the ILS market, I mean, there'd been a significant focus already on sort of quota share terms last year. There's been a toughening up on aggregates, and as you mentioned earlier, people sort of shifting away from the cascading coverages and things like that. Do you think that progress has already been made for the better in the ILS market on this, and is there a lot more to do at this renewals?
Well, let me first of all just define progress. Progress, I think, doesn't mean that people aren't covered for things they need to be covered for. Progress means that risks are understood, defined, properly underwritten, and properly paid for. So the issue is not that we have an expanding pool of capital in the industry between the traditional market and the alternative market, and what they should be doing is underwriting on a sustainable way, correctly defining the risks, and then getting paid for them, then paying out when it makes sense. So that's why I said that named perils are the central issue, and trying to shift. You know, I'm not saying that the industry shouldn't cover intangible risks. I'm saying the industry shouldn't cover intangible risks under the rubric of physical damage contracts. The industry should step back and actually cover intangible risks robustly on a properly underwritten basis. We actually do that. We have collateralized reinsurance of cyber and of intellectual property on our books. That's the faster growing part of the economy. Like we, you know, in order to grow, we need to be taking those risks seriously. But taking them seriously means that you actually underwrite them, not that you just have them hanging off the edge of a physical damage or a CMP policy. So I think that named perils are a priority for this year end. I think that co-participation is a priority for this year end and for this coming June. I think that making sure that there's proper alignment from end to end through the system should be a real priority.
Great, thank you, Mike. James, at AXIS, renewals approaching. Are you focusing on specific areas of the book, and are they receiving more attention than others, perhaps in terms of wordings? And also, how do you, your department, sort of get involved in that renewal process when you're analysing what terms are on offer?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and I think it's kind of behoven on any sort of good claims department really to see the input to our underwriters ahead of renewals as being well ahead of renewals. And by that, I mean, it really should be an all year round process. I think the best way to help arm certainly our underwriters with information to make the best possible decisions is to ensure a regular flow of relevant information, what we're seeing, what we're hearing on every claim or potential claims out there. So I would characterize it, and I think it's the best way to do it, as being an all year round process from a claims perspective in terms of internal feedback and input to underwriters. It's very much a living, breathing thing. And within that, I would say we probably break, from a claims perspective, break our approach down into two parts, probably a retrospective and a prospective view. What I mean by that on retrospective would be probably a focus on a lessons learned type of approach for our underwriters. So what did we learn in some cases maybe where you know, we recognized there was a need to pay out to our clients. And to Heather's point earlier, I think is a great one. There are times when it was not an outcome that maybe you had in contemplation when you wrote the business. It wasn't part of the risk you thought you'd assumed. But when you sit and a specific loss has come and you look at it, you know, our obligation and our promise is to pay when that's what the wording tells us. And I think we have to recognize that and be prepared to pay and pay fast when that happens, even if we might not have liked it. And we've seen plenty of examples of those challenges throwing themselves up. Now you can use coronavirus again, obviously we've talked about it a lot already, the non-PD related BI losses. Then secondly, on the prospective side, I think it's always very important to focus on identifying trends or emerging risks, really an attempt, and this is where you can make the real gains, to try to head those off at the pass, because obviously once a loss has happened, you've incurred the loss. And you know, arguably now where there's a harder market, that might also facilitate changing some wordings or some exposures that we've been aware of for some time. It may not be an upcoming one, but the timing's not been right to be able to enforce change and bring about a real meaningful change in those wordings. just to give an example on the prospective side, maybe for people, and just to stick to the coronavirus example, you know, we've seen recently coming out of Australia some state class actions in relation to some of the states in Victoria's response to the pandemic. You know, that's again not something that would have been considered, but that's something that has happened now. Is that going to happen more broadly or similar? I think these are things that, you know, we need to think now about ahead of renewals, because this could be an expansion of where we see, and there are other directions that might go, the coronavirus question coming in 2021.
Yeah, that's very interesting, James. Heather, would you concur with that from your side at another reinsurer?
Yeah, no, I would actually. And I think to use a property damage example for for the coronavirus going into next year, no one wants to insure a burning building. Hey? So we need to make sure that the losses are very clear as to where they're falling.
Yeah, thank you. Mike, turning to you, you mentioned social inflationary pressures. Is this an area that wordings and terms and conditions can be used by the ILS market in particular, but I guess more broadly as well in reinsurance to try and reduce some of that factor coming through? Obviously, named perils is one way of doing that, but do you think that the market can sort of negotiate better terms, more favorable terms on some of those contracts in Florida and other places?
Well, not entirely clear. I think that a key mechanism is actually to improve alignment. I think when you have 100% insured layers, then the ceding companies are just not as sharply motivated to settle claims crisply, because claims just move around and you know, they're spectators. You know, they move around through the reinsurers' layers. So alignment becomes more important in dealing with social inflation. But social inflation is just a real drift term. It has several root causes. One root cause is the amount of money that is being raised and deployed into the plaintiff's bar through alternative litigation finance. All litigation finance money is not necessarily being deployed into, you know, each and every, you know, homeowners claim settlement, but it certainly does back themes that cause claims to inflate. Assignment of benefits type, public use of public adjusters, all of these factors are driving claims up. There are two deeper root causes. One is the way that policyholders view policies is evolving a bit. It's a bit problematic for the industry. As opposed to viewing a policy as a way that you will remedy a loss and try to make yourself whole if you've suffered damage, some of the rhetoric, especially from that comes from the alt litigation finance community, is that you should treat your policy as an asset that you should maximize. That's actually, you know, that leads to a different mentality and a different approach to settlement. But I think that genie is out of the bottle. I think that the moral hazard between policyholders and companies has evolved a little bit, and we just have to price for it. And another issue that we have is that public attitudes in the U.S. around tort litigation have evolved. You know, we had an explosion of tort claims in the U.S. in the 1980s, and it finally ended when tort litigation threatened the ability of people to do things they wanted to do every day. You know, high schools canceled their sports seasons. You know, playgrounds were padlocked because people couldn't afford liability insurance. That set in motion a 20-year tide of public sentiment in favor of tort reform. And that was a two-decade-long movement in legislatures. But that has largely spent itself, I think. I think that younger generations have no familiarity with these experiences. I think that they often regard lawyers as crusaders. You know, I think that tort, the public momentum behind tort reform has petered out. The industry talks about, you know, millennial juries as being more, you know, more defendant friendly, or more plaintiff friendly, excuse me. And this is really what I'm talking about too. So This all goes to say that social inflation is a little bit relentless, and you need to price for it. You're not going to just exclude it with terms, although alignment does become more important.
Thank you, Mike. That's really helpful. Heather, so moving to you, obviously on the pandemic, the exclusion of communicable diseases has been sort of a focus at the moment and seems to set to be absolute in most quarters of the marketplace. But do you feel there are other areas within the market, within contracts, that companies should be examining to protect against similarly unexpected or forecastable losses?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Steve. And I do. And while cyber is certainly shouldn't be unexpected, I really don't think we've got our arms around it as yet. You know, I'm sure most will be familiar on the call with the term silent cyber for losses stemming from traditional property and liability policies that weren't intended or designed to cover cyber risk and therefore didn't implicitly include or exclude cyber risk. And this coverage ambiguity can still result in silent cyber or non-affirmative cyber coverage. You know, there has been, this shouldn't be a surprise to people, but that doesn't mean to say that, and I really don't think that the industry has got their arms around the exposure. The PRA and the rating agencies expect us to be able to identify, quantify, and manage cyber insurance underwriting risk to ensure that there's no shocks. And I'm sure that everyone is taking this very seriously. But the global property and casualty markets are filled with massive insurance programs written decades ago, often with outdated exclusions. And I think we've got a long way to go to achieve clarity on the $3 trillion of non-life premium over multiple lines. And I worry about a large cyber event, you know, which, like coronavirus, has no geographical boundaries, and the impact on traditional covers. You know, as Mike said, I think that this is quite rightly a growth area and a reaction to the modern world, in particular thinking about the increased use of cloud computing and a lot of these intangible assets, which is not covered, and actually a real opportunity for us as traditional reinsurers and alternative reinsurers to get our arms around this. But I was chatting to a cyber risk broker friend of mine over the weekend, and you know, people are not battening, you know, bashing on his door trying to buy this cover. I think risk managers are constrained in their budgets, and so we're not necessarily seeing the standalone cyber coverage certainly being provided by the traditional markets that one might expect. And so I would continue to highlight cyber risk as something that we really need to keep our eyes on, both in terms of making sure we don't have unexpected losses, but also making sure that we continue to provide proactive solutions for our clients.
Great. Thank you, Heather. James, any comments on areas of the market such as cyber at all?
I think it's probably been very well, in the interest of time, very well covered already. So I don't have, I don't think anything much to add on that one.
Sure. So at Access, though, you're all sort of focusing on trying to get your terms and conditions into a state where you can begin to roll these out to your clients, I suppose. And while at the same time, are you trying to ensure that your retrocession terms support the terms that you're giving out on the front end?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, I think, probably for us the key to this. And that was mentioned, I think, by Heather earlier, is the importance of making sure you have that consistency. I think for us, I mean, the one link I would make to cyber in this regard would be that, you know, it was a product that we've really sort of jumped into in more recent times in quite a big way. And that sort of dovetailed fairly well into when we really started sort of picking up our own retro. So for us, it was good timing and a good exercise to go through in actually approaching the two and building the two up together. So in that space, at least, I think we've always done a good and consistent job in that. It's a bit more difficult when you get to much more sprawling coverages, as we've just been talking about, because there's just so much in there, much of it unexpected exposures, and sometimes as well just difficult to fully align it, because there's a bigger market out there, a lot of other clients with other needs, and you can't always, as it's just one piece of the jigsaw, change the dynamics on your own. You really do need there to be support from the market and a market shift pulling in that same direction, and you know, that's certainly from my perspective, I hope that we might be starting to see now.
Sure, and that's come through loud and clear really from this discussion, that the market as a whole needs to be moving on some of these issues. Mike, any final comments from yourself, because we are just about up on time?
No, I mean, to what Heather and James was saying, not PTF was a foreshock for coronavirus. It's what we're talking about, not Petya. You know, some Ukrainian guys send ransomware around the world, generates ultimately $3 billion plus of insured claims, of which about $300 million hit explicit cyber. So let me propose a general thesis of insurance, which is that if corporations are buying corporate level cover, you need to make sure that all their risks are covered, because even if they're not, they'll come after you anyway. You know, not Petya, you know, $3 billion of silent cyber against $300 million of explicit cyber. And this is what I'm talking about. We should actually be aggressively thinking about these intangible risks and making sure to box and contain and price and underwrite them. Because the corporations have those risks anyway, and they're going to try to use a very creative plaintiff's bar to find ways that their existing coverages indirectly actually wrap over those. So it's a mission for the industry, but I want to make the mission happiness. The happy mission is companies need this industry. The industry has the skills to do this. If we can cut ourselves free from a 1950s policy framework, we will be so much better for people that actually need this industry to function for them.
Thank you, Mike. That's a great way to end the session. I'm sorry to our audience, we haven't had time for any of your questions today, but like me, you probably didn't imagine that a terms and conditions and wordings discussion would end up being a very positive one on new product opportunities. So thank you to James, thank you to Heather, and thank you to Mike for their participation. Really appreciate it. Really enjoyed your points today. To all of our audience, we've got another session in just less than an hour's time about capital raising in the industry, so please do join us then. And thanks again to our panelists. Really appreciate your taking part.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Steve. Thanks. Bye.